WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ever since September 11th, Americans have been asking, why do they hate us? My guest Bernard Lewis tried to respond to that question back in the September 1990 issue of The Atlantic in a cover story on the roots of Muslim rage. He has a new piece in this month's Atlantic. Last month, he had an article in The New Yorker titled The Revolt of Islam. When did the conflict with the West begin and how could it end? Lewis has spent his life studying the Middle East and Islam. He's a professor emeritus of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University. He has a new book of his translations of classical Arabic, Persian, Turkish, and Hebrew poems called Music of a Distant Drum. He also has a new book that will be published next month titled What Went Wrong? Western Impact and Middle Eastern Response. I asked him, now that the Afghans are so relieved to be free of the Taliban, might the U.S. seem less like a villain and more like a force for good to people in the Islamic world?
Most of the Middle East falls into one of two groups. On the one hand, there are countries with governments which are said to be pro-American and whom we regard as friends and allies. And in those countries, particularly Egypt and Saudi Arabia, the population is fanatically, passionately anti-American, because they regard us as responsible for the tyrants that rule over them. And it's no accident that most of the hijackers came from those two countries. On the other hand, there are countries like Iraq and Iran where the governments are anti-American and where the people, therefore, are very strongly pro-American. It was very remarkable immediately after September the 11th. Thousands of people in Iran spontaneously went out into the streets and held vigils to express sympathy and compassion. This was not organized. On the contrary, the state tried to prevent it. It was a spontaneous expression of goodwill. And I don't have the slightest doubt that the scenes of rejoicing in Afghanistan will look like a funeral compared with what we would see in Iraq and Iran if they were liberated from their present rulers.
Now, you mentioned that, a lot of the extremists come from Saudi Arabia and Egypt because they live under tyrants there. In what way is the Saudi family tyrannical in their ruling over Saudis?
Oh, tyrannical, I think, is too strong a word, but certainly very autocratic. And in the modern age, particularly with modern media and modern communications, people are less tolerant of that than they used to be. And the media have made an enormous contribution to this. I mean, there have always been differences between the rich and the poor, between the powerful and the powerless. But usually the poor and the powerless were very little aware of those differences. Now they see them and hear them every day, thanks to the mass media. And this is a major source of the deep and growing frustration and resentment.
You've said that what lies behind Muslim anger is three centuries of defeat, decline, and impotence in the Muslim world. I know you can't describe three centuries for us, but can you give us a sense of what you mean by that?
Let me try to explain. For the first 1,000 years or so of Islamic history, that is to say, from the career of the Prophet and the advent of Islam in the 7th century, Islam saw itself, and to a large extent, rightly, as the dominant civilization in the world. The most powerful, the wealthiest, the most creative, advancing on all its territorial frontiers, advancing also on all the frontiers of knowledge. There were setbacks. They had conquered Spain. They lost Spain. But that was more than compensated by their advances. And as recently, so to speak, as the 17th century, there were still Turkish pashas ruling in Budapest and in Belgrade, Turkish armies besieging Vienna, and North African corsairs raiding the coasts of England and Ireland. And then suddenly everything changed. They were defeated on every battlefield. They lost every war. And not only in war, but they were defeated also not only on the battlefield, but in the marketplace, when suddenly they found themselves being outsold, outproduced by this upstart Western world. Let me illustrate this with an example. Sugar and coffee are both commodities which were unknown in the Western world. They were imported from the Middle East, and they figured prominently in the balance of payment, balance of trade, between the Middle East and the Western world. Then the Europeans learnt to grow sugar and to grow coffee in their colonial plantations, and they did it more efficiently and more cheaply than the locals, so that by the 18th century, coffee and sugar are import items from the West and no longer export items to the West. So that by the 18th century, if a Turk or an Arab permitted himself that traditional indulgence, a cup of sweet coffee, the chances were that the coffee came from Java or the West Indies, and that the sugar came from somewhere in Central America and was refined somewhere in Western Europe. The only thing that was local was the hot water. And by the 19th century, even that ceased to be true because European companies took over most of the utilities. There was this feeling of frustration in a society accustomed to a position of preeminence and indeed dominance. And another point which I think is very important, a society with a very strong sense of history. In this country, if you say of something, that's history, you mean it's unimportant, irrelevant, of no value for present concerns. This is not the Middle Eastern view. History is very much present around them all the time. During the Iraq-Iran War, 1980 to 1988, I had occasion to look at the propaganda of both sides. It was full of rapid, passing, incomplete allusions to events in history 1,000 or more years ago. And they didn't need any explanations, and they knew perfectly well that their readers would pick them up and understand them. In the same way, when Osama bin Laden spoke of this shame and humiliation which we have suffered for more than 80 years, people here were rushing around in circles. What happened 80 years ago? What's he referring to? I don't think anybody in the Middle East had the slightest doubt as to what he was referring to.
What was it?
He was referring to the final defeat and occupation of the Ottoman Empire, the last of the great Islamic states.
In your recent writings, you've said that you think that Al-Qaeda and other extremist Islamic groups have caught on in part by working with this victim mentality. Why did they do this to us? Who is the they, and what is the this that they're being accused of having done?
Well, let me try to put this in a historical context.
Yeah.
As I said, during the last 300 years or so, things have gone badly wrong from their point of view. And there is an increasing awareness among all levels of society in all these countries that things have gone badly wrong as compared with what went before and as compared with what is happening in other parts of the world. I mean, they've not only fallen behind the West, they've also fallen behind such new societies as Korea, Taiwan, and so on. So when you become very much aware that things have gone badly wrong, there are two questions you can ask. You can ask, what did we do wrong? In which case, the next question is, how do we put it right? And that is what the Turks have been doing in their slow and painful road to, I would say, a real democracy. The other question you can ask is, who did this to us? And that leads you into a sort of twilight zone of conspiracy theories and neurotic fantasies. And that, I'm afraid, is what the path that many have chosen. Now, the malefactors, those whom they accuse of having done it to them, have varied considerably. It has been the imperialists, and then, of course, there are various candidates for the role. It has been the Jews for quite a number. It has been, on a smaller scale, the communists, and so on and so on. And going back to earlier times, and they accused the Mongols, and they've also accused each other. The Turks accused the Arabs accused the Turks, and so on. Now, America is undoubtedly the prime candidate, because America is what we call the leader of the free world. They wouldn't put it in those terms. They would say the leader or chief of the House of Unbelief. The world is divided into the believers, which means the Muslims, and the unbelievers. And they see this as a competition between the two world religions that has been going on for 14 centuries. The enemy in the past was headed by the Byzantine emperors in Constantinople, the Holy Roman emperors in Vienna, the British and French empires, and so on. Now the United States has inherited that role.
Why is America more the enemy now than it was, say, 30 years ago?
Because America now is the undisputed head of the free world. There is no rival. There is no alternative.
How was it different in the Cold War?
Well, there was a Soviet Union, an alternative power. And, of course, many of them turned to the alternative powers. I mean, during the World War, there was considerable support for the Third Reich. After the end of the war and the Cold War, there was considerable support for the Soviet Union. Now, there is no alternative. They find themselves face to face with the only serious power in the Western world.
Now, you've pointed out how paradoxical it is that when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan in the late 1970s, it was the United States that went to the aid of the Afghans who were trying to drive the Soviets out. It wasn't other Arab countries, it was the United States. What kind of sense do you make of that, given what's happening now? Yeah,
it's not paradoxical that the United States went to the aid of the Afghans. What is remarkable is the very limited support that the Afghans got from their Muslim brothers. Even the Organization of the Islamic Congress could only bring itself to vote a very lukewarm condemnation. And at the United Nations, the same thing happened. They were scared of the Soviet Union. Then, of course, came the Afghan wars, and they feel that they were the ones who defeated and destroyed the Soviet Union. And they feel that having dealt with one of the superpowers, they are capable of dealing with the other. They regard the United States as a much easier opponent than the Soviet Union, less ferocious, less determined. And one of the things which comes out very clearly in the writings of Osama bin Laden is not the hatred. I mean, if you ask why do they hate us, you're asking the wrong question. The question is not why do they hate us. They've been hating us for centuries. And the us has varied, but always meaning the world of the infidels. What is new and dangerous is that they no longer fear or respect us. And that is quite clear from Osama bin Laden's writings. And this is why I feel that the events of the last few weeks may have brought a really significant change. Osama bin Laden speaks of the Americans in his various interviews and declarations as paper tigers. They have gone soft. They can't take casualties. Hit them and they'll run. This is a recurring theme. And there's a sort of repeated litany. Vietnam, Lebanon, Somalia. Hit them and they'll run. This was the theme. It was hatred, yes. But the important thing is that the hatred was not restrained by fear or tempered by respect. I think that he and his followers will have changed their minds on that point now.
My guest is historian Bernard Lewis. His new book, What Went Wrong, Western Impact and Middle Eastern Response, will be published next month. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is historian Bernard Lewis. His new book, What Went Wrong, Western Impact and Middle Eastern Response, will be published next month. He's written extensively about the Islamic world. Bin Laden has sent, or at least allowed, people who are his followers to go on suicide missions. And he didn't seem to be bothered at all that some of the hijackers didn't even know what the nature of their mission was and didn't know, even though they understood that they were being chosen for martyrdom, they didn't know that this mission was necessarily that mission that was going to martyr them. What does the Quran have to say about suicide missions? Is there any precedent in the Quran for that type of fighting?
None whatever. On the contrary, the whole Islamic tradition is against suicide. Suicide is considered in the Muslim tradition to be a mortal sin. One who commits suicide forfeits paradise and is doomed to eternal hell. And his punishment in hell will consist of the unending repetition of the act of suicide. I mean, it is one thing to throw yourself to a certain death against a much stronger enemy. It is quite another to die by your own hand. And this is made perfectly clear in Muslim writings. There is a very early Muslim tradition, according to which a Muslim soldier was mortally wounded, was lying on the battlefield dying, and in order to shorten his pain, he killed himself with his own sword. And the Prophet said that God said that, I quote, "My servant has preempted me by taking his own life, he shall not enter paradise." That's not Quran, but it's a very early Muslim tradition. And it does, I think, express the basic Muslim view concerning suicide. The idea that the suicide bomber also can be considered as a martyr on the battlefield and qualify for the rewards of paradise is a very new one And I would say that in their own terms, these people are taking a big chance on eternity.
Do you think that the Gulf War contributed to the hatreds that have resulted in terrorist attacks against the United States?
Yes, I do. I mean, first of all, the manner of ending the Gulf War. The actual fighting of the Gulf War, no, because it was to rescue two Arab Islamic countries from attack by a third. Kuwait was occupied, Saudi Arabia was threatened, and the United States came in at their request to help them. Nothing wrong with that. But then, in the course of the war, we called on the Iraqi people to rise in rebellion against the tyrant that ruled over them. They did so. And then, after the ceasefire, we sat and watched while Saddam Hussein brutally suppressed these risings, crushed the rebels group by group and region by region, while we sat and watched, and he used the helicopters, which we had thoughtfully allowed him to retain under the terms of the ceasefire. This was a very unedifying spectacle. And the message was, we don't mind what you do to your own people. We don't mind what kind of tyrannical regime you set up, as long as you meet our requirements. Saddam Hussein, for example, to replace him, it was argued at the time, would be dangerous. What we wanted is not a change of regime, but a change of ruler. Change of regime would open up all sorts of new issues and new uncertainties. What we wanted is to replace the tyrant by a more amenable tyrant who would be amenable to our purposes. That made a very bad and very painful impression. It reinforced the feeling among many that the West in general, the United States in particular, does not regard them as civilized human beings with the same rights and aspirations as others, but simply as people of backward cultures only fit to be ruled by tyrants. All that matters is that they should be our tyrants and not somebody else's tyrants. I think that is an oversimplification, but it is not a falsification, as I said before. And there is a lot of evidence to reinforce that impression. I won't say to prove it or confirm it, but to reinforce that impression, certainly.
Bernard Lewis is my guest. He's a scholar of the Arab world, a professor at Princeton University, and author of the new book, What Went Wrong? Western Impact and Middle Eastern Response, that will be published in January. In addition to your new book, What Went Wrong?, you've edited a new book of classical Arabic, Persian, Turkish, and Hebrew poems. The book is called Music of a Distant Drum.
Yes, these are translations, poems that caught my fancy and which I tried my hand at translating into English.
I'm wondering if you could leave us with one of the classical Arabic poems that you translated.
Arabic, no, I don't recall one, but I don't have the book with me, but I can give you a Turkish one.
Sure.
By a 15th century Turkish woman, a quatrain. Woman, they say, is deficient in sense. Therefore they ought to pardon her every fault. But one female who knows what to do is worth more than 1,000 males who don't.
I'm going to ask you to speculate why that part of the world, by our standards, has gone backwards and not forwards in terms of women. Why women have more covering them even than they used to.
As you can imagine, there's an enormous literature on this subject, from inside as well as from outside. And many different explanations have been offered. There's a Turkish writer called Namık Kemal, in an article published in 1868, uses some very striking images. He says that the reason for our backwardness compared with the West is that we deprive ourselves of the talents and services of half the population, so that our society is like a human body that is paralyzed on one side. I think that's a very striking image and a very accurate one. The position of women in the Western world in pre-modern times, and for that matter in modern times, was very far from one of equality. But it was in most respects incomparably better than that of women in the Middle East. And for one thing, there was no legal polygamy or concubinage. Women had somewhat better property rights in Islamic law until modern times, but in every other respect, they were constrained, repressed, and the society was accordingly impoverished. When Mustafa Kemal Atatürk founded the Turkish Republic, one of his first campaigns was for women's rights. Difficult to imagine anything more improbable than an Ottoman Pasha and a general as a campaigner for feminist causes. Nevertheless, he did, and he gave his reasons with true military terseness. He said, and this is in the early 20s, he said, "Our task now is to catch up with the modern world. We will not catch up with the modern world if we only modernize half the population."
What are your concerns about the post-Taliban government in Afghanistan?
I think they seem to be doing fairly well so far. It's a very difficult country to rule. It's a wild, rugged, mountainous country with a very independent people who have not acquired the habit of submission as so many of their neighbors. A difficult country to rule at the best of times, but much worse now after Soviet occupation, the struggle against it, the wars that followed, and then the Taliban. But I spent a little while in Afghanistan, and I must say I have confidence in the ability of the Afghan people to work things out when they're left to themselves.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Bernard Lewis is Professor Emeritus of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton. His new book of translations of classic Arab, Persian, Turkish, and Hebrew poems is called Music of a Distant Drum. His book, What Went Wrong? Western Impact and Middle Eastern Response, will be published next month. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.